So, I'm giving a talk this week on compulsions. Before I start discussing what how to work with compulsions, I should pretty much define it for you, because actually how to delineate habits from compulsions from addictions can be fuzzy, and so for all of us, I think it's great to have sort of a common ground. A habit is something that we like doing, but there's a choice. For instance, on a nice, beautiful day, courtesy of global warming, I can I like to ride my bike. I also like to sit outside. I like to go to my favorite Vietnamese to-go place in my neighborhood, and I like to listen to whatever. So there's a lot of choices there. And if one of them I can't do, if my bike gets a flat or it suddenly starts to rain or whatever, I don't suffer. So you generally can tell when somebody's got a habit. They say, I like to do this, or I usually do that. There's a sort of linguistic acknowledgement that there's a choice. When there's a compulsion, we see that there's no longer a choice, that there's one thing that will do to ease an underlying state of tension. So we might say, I've got to have a cigarette right now. Or I've got to get those new, you know, sneakers by whatever. New Balance. I don't know what people wear. But anyway, I've got to have those new shoes. I've got to have a cigarette. I've got to, you know, have a couple of beers and unwind. Whatever. So when we get to the level of compulsion, it's A, is an indication that there's some tension underlying it, and B, that there's no longer an unlimited series of choices that we can choose from. There's one thing that we're going from for to relieve ourselves. And then addiction is when we've crossed a boundary, and this behavior no longer needs any underlying reason to trigger it. We just do it. And whatever we're addicted to, we generally do it to such a degree that it begins to sabotage elements in our life. And so there begins to be also a sense of denial and covering up. So if a habit is, oh, I like to ride my bike on a nice day, and compulsion is, I've got to have a cigarette, that you won't believe the day I had, then addiction is, I didn't have a cigarette. I didn't drink last night, because we're no longer even capable of discussing. We're no longer capable of even acknowledging the degree to which this behavior has taken over our lives. So tonight we're talking about compulsions. And as I said, compulsions are indicative of an underlying tension. We're unconsciously trying to relieve ourselves of an uncomfortable inner state. Generally, we are often unaware of the degree of the discomfort that's inside. We're partially unaware because we're so driven to get and do that compulsive behavior externally. Compulsive behaviors are external things that mask or relieve underlying states of tension. Whenever we're running towards something, we're running away from something. So when I'm running towards a compulsion, it's because I'm trying to ease, relieve, get away from control, an underlying state. And if we don't realize this, we tend to combat our compulsions. And combat is a very important word. We try to battle with them. We act as if every time we've binge shopped, it's because we made a bad choice. But with compulsions, there is no choice. We're driven. And we're driven because we're so uncomfortable. So if we treat a compulsion like it's simply a bad choice, or there's some underlying demon that I'm trying to get rid of, or trying to, in me, that's trying to take over, I'll never succeed with working with my compulsions. I have to go to what is the underlying cause and view the compulsion itself as a symptom. This is very much not only the way that contemporary therapy works with it, and contemporary you know, social workers work with it, that I work with, but it's also the way the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago. To treat a compulsion as a symptom and look for what are the causes and conditions that create the tension beneath it that make us want to act out. So I'm going to give you an incomplete list of what some compulsions are, and this is by no means, there's so many different compulsions that people have, but just so we have an idea of some of them, there's of course compulsive nicotine use, shopping, there's compulsive shoplifting, there's compulsive cleaning of oneself and compulsive cleaning of one's house, there's compulsive sex and compulsive masturbation, there's compulsive food, there's compulsive internet surfing, there's compulsive checking in with work, there's compulsive Facebooking, compulsive texting. Anything that gets us out of the underlying physical, emotional tension and externalizes it with something that relieves it can turn into a compulsion if we start to lose our choices, if we become driven, if we start to suffer when we can't act out on the compulsion and relieve the underlying tension. So again, the reason why compulsions generally don't go away is because we continually go back to the external symptom and we don't acknowledge and look at the underlying tension that is creating the energy or the drive to act out. Now, it so happens that if you if you're like me and you read a lot of books on addiction and compulsion therapies and all the clinical studies, that generally all compulsions, as do all drugs, fall under two categories. The first category is those that thrill the mind. And the second category is those that chill, that bring us down. So thrill and chill. Very helpfully, I've made them rhyme. Actually, I didn't make them rhyme. It's actually, it's in so many textbooks now, the thrill and chill, you wouldn't believe it. So, but it's easy to remember. Now, some of the compulsions can do both. Like, for instance, depending on how fast you smoke a cigarette, it can thrill, energize the mind, or it can chill you down if you smoke it really slowly. There are some, sex can be both a thrill, it could be a chill. Some people use it to calm down. There are certain compulsions that are almost invariably things that chill us down that relieve us of anxiety. For example, cleaning. Cleaning is almost invariably a symptom of somebody that's anxious who wants to calm down the mind by doing something that's repetitive and soothing and gives a state of release of serotonin. On the other hand, gambling and shoplifting are, guess what? Thrills, exactly. Once in a while, I throw something out to see if you're still awake and paying attention. So, let's look at an example. There is the case of the, I'm just going to use examples right now. It's so just view these as examples. But suppose you have a suburban teenager that doesn't feel like their parents are listening, they're awkward in the process of socializing themselves with others, they feel completely powerless in their lives, and so they might develop a compulsive shoplifting. And what they're doing in the shoplifting is they're trying to bring a sense of energy and excitement and involvement in their life. So when they're trying to get away and steal the object from the store, they're looking for that feeling that relieves them of this underlying state of depression. They're looking for excitement. They're looking for a thrill. Most people who are shoplifters do not shoplift for the thing they're actually stealing. Generally, people, in fact, steal things that they already have. It's interesting. People tend to go back and back and steal CDs or whatever, even though CDs is so, 1995, but whatever. Steal flash drives. I don't know what the fuck they're stealing, but people are stealing, and it really doesn't matter what they're stealing. They're after the thrill. On the other hand, if you're a, certainly if you are a guy, you've known many compulsive masturbators over your life. That's generally a symptom of guys that have a lot of restlessness and are trying to relieve anxiety. So you get the idea. There are behaviors that thrill. There's behaviors that chill. So the root of what we want to do is we want to do three things. We want to, A, understand what is the underlying tension that we're trying to relieve, rather than get caught up in the symptom. There's a wonderful example. I was working with somebody years ago, this guy who had this, and this will give you an idea of how many years ago, because he would go and buy porn from magazine shops. And, you know, now in the last 15 years it's been the internet, so this was a long time ago, but he would go buy porn, and then he would get really upset with himself that he had done it. And he would wonder why he would then go back and do it again. And of course, the reason is because if we get upset with ourselves after we've compulsively acted out, we're creating more tension. We're creating more stress. That makes us act out again. If I'm feeling tense and agitated, and I do a compulsive action that's meant to bring a state of ease, and then I judge myself, all I'm doing is creating a feedback loop. I'm creating in my reactions the causes to have me act out again. So we want to instead focus on the underlying causes, see what they are, so that we can then, two, we can work with relieving them. And three, we can develop useful tools to thrill and chill the mind so that when life inevitably does have its stresses, we'll have successful ways to relax ourselves that will not be self-sabotaging. The Buddha said that every single tool, with the exception of mindfulness, which is awareness, but every single other tool he developed fell under the category of energizing the mind or relaxing the mind. He knew very well that the mind is constantly caught up in this need to either find something that will chill us or thrill us. So even if we see the underlying cause of our compulsion and we rid ourselves of it, there will still be in life stresses that crop up that will cause tension that will make us want to relieve the state. Nobody is ever completely, for the rest of their lives, in an easeful state. Life throws us things like loss, rejection. We suffer changes in our bodies and our friends. There's loss of people we love. You get the idea. So even if we do relieve ourselves of the underlying causes and conditions that make us compulsively act out, new tensions will arise. So we need to both see what's causing the compulsion, but we also have to develop tools that we can use when we're tense that won't sabotage us. Like, for example, shoplifting or, you know, a lot of these, for instance, compulsive TV watching, where people watch 6-8 hours a day. There's people who wash their hands 20 and 30 times a day. There are people who you know, shop to the point where it begins to have a serious financial consequences. There are people who wind up compulsively acting out sexually in ways that cause a sense of lowering self-esteem. So we want to develop tools that we can use to cope with underlying tension successfully and also address the underlying tension. So the first ways of noting what's the underlying tension is, again, if you're doing something that's obviously, your compulsion obviously indicates what's going on, then you can stop right there. For instance, people who sleep, beyond, like 14 hours a day, almost invariably have depression. people who shoplift almost invariably have a sense of not of being powerless in their own lives. But most of the compulsions don't directly indicate what the underlying tension is, what the underlying suffering is. So then the second thing we can do is, after we act out, we can reflect on what occurred in our lives directly before we compulsively acted out. So, for example, and this the Buddha termed under positive reflection, we can stop and we can, after, for instance, we've been shopped, or we've gambled even though we didn't want to, or we've compulsively binged on food or whatever, we can stop and reflect, okay, what changed that made me fall back into this behavior? Sometimes we'll find that it's we've taken on too many responsibilities. Sometimes we'll find that we haven't been creative, that we've just been working and we haven't been finding a creative outlet. Sometimes we'll find that we've been swallowing resentments, that there's somebody in our lives that's really pushing our buttons and we're not trying to communicate. We're just swallowing the anger. All these things, if we note them, can be the cause, and then we can begin to see how they play out in our bodies and in our minds. For example, anger tends to create a real sense of tightness in the chest and in the arms, and it creates a jaw that locks, and it creates a brow that's tight. It creates, you know, just this clenched experience. So we can begin to see all the physical manifestations of it, and we can begin to see the mental manifestations of anger. We start to obsess about the person and about how we've been victimized, and then we create such an uncomfortable state that we want to find something to soothe us. So we then, at the end of the week, we might do whatever compulsive thing relieves us of our anger. It might be that we yell at somebody that has nothing to do with the person that is causing the, or is a part of the trigger. So this sometimes works, reflecting on what has developed in our lives before we act out. The problem is, though, a lot of the time it doesn't work out. Why? Well, two reasons. One, we have busy, complex lives where we're doing a million different things, and pinpointing a single thing that we've added that is the culprit is often very difficult. It's one thing if we have lives that are pretty consistent and then we suddenly add on a new relationship or a new job or something like that, and suddenly the tension rises and suddenly we're binge eating or we're not eating or we're suddenly constantly on the internet till 4 a.m, well, then you can say, okay, I'm acting out. The only thing that's really changed is I've been in a new relationship, so fuck, I've got to investigate this. But often there's so much going on that we really can't be sure. And sometimes the chief culprit has happened a long time ago. People can, for instance, lose a parent and have this feeling really, really pat down. And over a long period of time, it'll come up. And then it'll start manifesting in compulsive behavior. And they won't even realize because, understandably, the parent's loss might have happened years previously. So you get the idea. It's not often that easy. But there is a way to see what's going on that's foolproof. And this is stopping in the midst of a compulsion for a moment and bringing our awareness inside and practicing mindfulness. If, even for a moment at first, we can stop and say, hey, wait, what's going on here? What am I feeling? What's happening? Then we can begin to see the underlying tension that's driving us, that's pushing us, and we can begin to relax it. So, for example, I know this. I studied with this one monk who told this story of he was working with a woman who was addicted to having a bunch of donuts every morning. And her only solution that worked was she would avoid the donut stop. She would walk blocks and blocks around the donut store so that she wouldn't see the donuts. And that was the only thing that worked. But what the monk instructed her to do was to actually go there and try to stop for 10 seconds. I heard an oh, but no. It doesn't have to be stop and not go in and forever. It means just stop and see all the components of the momentum that's pushing me to eat, to splurge, to buy, to hook up, to smoke a cigarette, to clean, to go on the internet, to check in with work, to text. What are the underlying components? That's what we want to see. So we want to stop focusing on the symptom, which is the thing we're going to act out on. We want to bring our attention to the underlying cause, and we want to see what comprises it. The Buddha said there will be four ways that we, or places we can look. The first is with the breath. The breath will either be way too fast. It will be sort of hyperventilation. That's like we're running, or we're literally working out. It's that kind of a breath. Or it'll be a very shallow, thin, incomplete, sleepy breath. One of the two will be occurring. The second thing we'll find is various areas of the body will either feel really tight and uncomfortable, like the stomach will feel tight, or the jaw will be locked, or the chest will be really compact, or the shoulders will be up around our ears. Or B, we might feel hollowness and emptiness inside. Again, a symptom of too much energy or too little. Third, we will expect to see in the mind that the mind is either jumping around, anxious, incapable of focusing and settling down, or the mind will just be too tired to even stay on anything. It won't even be able to focus long enough to even have a complete thought. It'll just feel overwhelmed. Again, too much energy, too little energy. And finally, there'll be the thoughts that are creating so much of the underlying tension. There'll be a thought along the lines of, I've got to have this, or if I don't get this thing, or if I don't, I really deserve this. If I don't get this, I'm going to be fucked. If I don't check in with work, they might fire me. So we might have thoughts that are screaming and predicting the future and creating a complete state of anxiety, or we might have the exact opposite. We might have just a thought that's just, fuck it, I give up. Who cares? Fuck this all. Fuck it. I'm fucked, you're fucked, we're fucked. So you get it. There's these various levels that the tension will play out. The tension can be an anxiousness, a jumpiness, or it can be a state of completely missing a vital sense of life, a sense of purpose, a sense of having any effectivity in the world. So look within. See what's going on. Finally, then we can begin to work with the symptoms. If there's tension, we can breathe into it. If the breath is really fast, we can make it full and relaxed. If the breath is shallow and incomplete, we can make it deeper. We can balloon breath so that we move the stomach visibly in and out. If the mind feels too jumpy, we can sit and focus for a while. We can, even if it's necessary, people go and they seek help, which is fine, from, psychiatrists. There are people that, with meditation and spiritual tools alone, cannot find a comfortable balance. And that's totally fine. We do whatever it takes to address the underlying symptom. If the thoughts are filled with restlessness and there's something wrong, we cultivate thoughts of gratitude, thoughts of feeling, or if we're feeling that we're purposeless, that we're alone, that nobody's paying attention, like, And it makes us want to seek a thrilling activity. Sometimes the Buddha said, just bringing to mind thoughts of appreciation for all the skillful things we've done to help others can be enough to bring a sense of my life matters, that my life has a purpose. So finally, a list of a couple of replacements that work, just briefly. If we're looking for thrilling activities, I've actually known people that were addicted to some really self-sabotaging thrills that then get really into the sort of what I call the mountain sports. The rock climbing, the rock biking, the bike rocking, whatever the fuck. The snowboarding, the climbing, there's also traveling that induces a thrill. There's exploring the places we live, going to a different neighborhood and just walking around. Doing volunteer work is a really safe, really skillful way to bring a sense of purpose into life that rarely has a downside. Exploring new cuisines, learning about something that we've always been interested in but never taken the time to explore it, taking classes. All these things are skillful antidotes to the I've got to thrill my life by shoplifting or, doing secretly binging on food or whatever it is that we're doing that that is self-sabotaging. On the other hand, I'm sure you'll be aware that meditation is a wonderful way to both especially calm the mind. It can energize the mind, certainly, but its strength, certainly, on a daily practice is that people who are incapable of relaxing and settling down over a period of even a short, diligent practice can develop a state of increasing inner calm. Massages. Some people like floating in pools. I know a friend who's got a hammock who sits on it for quite a while. Some people swear by relaxing scents, as in aromas, candles, stuff like that. Never works for me. I'm just always like, what's that smell? I like incense, but it's never like, ooh, incense. No, I thank you. I don't have that. It's just, I like it. It's like, oh, that's a nice aroma. I can live with that. Yeah, that's nice. But some people, it's a very key to us to a calming state. And then there's, of course, slow music. And then there's also some people really like a mixture of both, which is what's known as proprioceptive. And what these are things that both add energy and then release and relax us. For example, yoga. At the beginning of yoga, it's strenuous getting into the various asanas. You can build up a sweat. But then at the end, we end at savasana, where you relax the body and it becomes very easy to find a state of peace. Variations, of course, are exercising and other forms of biking and walking around the city and then relaxing and sitting and reading. So there are those proprioceptive approaches where we work ourselves up to build up a sense of involvement and a positiveness in life and a sense of flowing of adrenaline, and then we relax and release serotonin. So you get a little bit of both. So that's my talk on compulsions, what they are, why we tend to work with them unskillfully, because we get caught up in just the symptoms rather than seeing the underlying causes, how to figure out the underlying causes, and what to do about them. So I thank you for listening. Now I'm going to turn off the tape, and it's your turn to ask any questions.